Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Good morning, Bill.
Good morning,
or
Aaron.
Or afternoon.
Yeah.
And we have Ben. He's a recently new engineer for us.
Good afternoon.
I like the sounds of a struggle in there with Ben. All right. So, we're going to get right at it because our guest asked how long he had to be on, and, well, we're not letting you go right away.
He's hostage.
Can't go right away because this is really a big topic. I mean, this goes on. So I have this whole bio here on WeThePeopleRadio.us. You can go read it. Got a link to his book, That Day in Dallas. Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill JFK. And the author of that book is Robert K. Tannenbaum. He is the author of 33 books. 29 of them are novels, and he has 4 nonfiction books. And I was hoping maybe he'd come back and talk to us about some of that on a different day. But he's one of the most successful prosecuting attorneys, having never lost a felony trial and convicting hundreds of violent criminals. He was a special prosecution consultant in the Hillside Strangler case in Los Angeles, and also defended Amy Grossberg in her sensationalized baby death case. He was assistant district attorney in New York County in the office of legendary district attorney Frank Hogan, where he ran the Homicide Bureau and served as chief of criminal courts. He was in charge of the DA's legal staff training program, also served as the deputy chief counsel for the Congressional Committee investigation into the assassination of President John F. Kennedy and Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. So he was also the mayor of Beverly Hills for 2 terms. He has been there and done that.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I might add some things later. Because there's more.
I think it sounds like he lives out of his car.
Or an airplane. But I wanted to get to him right away so that we could maximize his time with us. So, Mr. Tannenbaum, or should we call you Mr. Former Mayor? Or you have a lot of titles.
Are you there?
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh. Hello.
Oh, there we go.
There
I'm
he is.
Here.
I was going to say.
Maybe your next guest, if you can hear me, Dennis Neal, author of the book, The Leadership Genius of Elon Musk. That was an incredibly impressive introduction you gave.
Well, we'll switch
another
up.
Another person.
Because in my emails, it said, this has been going on for about a month and a half. Who's coming on when? And so apparently who's on first is incorrect. So, we take all that back. Dennis Neal. You
very funny, and you know what? That's the great thing about live broadcasting.
It is.
Anything could happen, and I so appreciate your time. And
I double-checked it, too. I really did. I guess maybe I should have un-double-checked it.
Let me just make it easy for you and tell you that for 30 years I was a business journalist. I was at the Wall Street Journal in New York. I was the managing editor of Forbes. I was an anchor at CNBC and Fox Business Network, and now I'm the host of the What's Bugging Me podcast, and I'm a frequent contributor to Newsmax. So I've spent a year on this book, and I came up with 11 lessons on what makes Elon Musk successful. And you can see him in play right now with what he's doing at Doge, a few of these lessons. And also, they're lessons that we can borrow to build a bigger life, a better life, or at least to feel better about the life we have.
Yeah, it was funny, too, because we passed a Tesla truck on our way in, and I sort of chuckled to myself. I'm like, well, we're going to find out all the inside dope on that.
Yeah, he's definitely an accomplished individual, and I don't think a lot of people know his background, and I think they know bits and pieces, but this should be very interesting to find out who he is and how he got to where he is, you know, the richest man in the world, and that doesn't happen by itself.
Your book was when I saw the announcement, The Leadership Genius of Elon Musk, I was like, oh, timely, super timely. So where do you want to start with all of this?
Well, we could start if you want to surf off the news, we could start with some of my 11 lessons where you can see them. They help you figure out how Elon operates and how he might be feeling right now. For example, lesson 3 says, the highest nail gets pounded down first. So strap on a helmet. And that's what Elon does. He invites the blistering attack that he gets. He says, you know, bring it. It's worth it. Whereas I think most of us, we shrink from that these days. Lesson 4 says, tease your critics and torture your enemies. And Elon Musk, man, he gives as good as he gets.
Yeah, we've seen that.
You know, the short sellers betting against Tesla stock over the last, I don't know, maybe 8-10 years, they've lost collectively $75 billion trying to short that stock, Tesla, while they've made back maybe only about $15 billion. So he really tortures short sellers at a time when most CEOs ignore them. And there's a lesson there for us to fight back harder, perhaps.
Well, and guys that know, I mean, he and President Trump are really well matched, you know, very well suited to one another in that neither one of them is deterred by, you know,
the critics.
The critics, the angry press, and the protests.
They're fueled by it. They're energized by it, aren't they?
Yeah. It's kind of it's funny, and I've always passed it off. I grew up back east, and so I've always passed it off with Donald Trump as a New York thing, but I guess we've done a lot of shows on South Africa, and honestly, I guess that follows too. A lot of criticism, and not all of it deserved.
Well, you know, the thing about these two men is, first of all, I think what brought them together, don't you think it's that old saying, the enemy of my enemy is my friend? And they are despised by the same forces, by the same ranks of people, really. And both men share other traits. They both way overpromise. You know, that's another lesson in the book, Lesson 11. It says, dream huge and be willing to spend decades pursuing it. You know, Elon Musk decided over 20 years ago he wanted to go to Mars as a private venture. He was willing to bet half of his fortune back then, $200 million. It's 1,000 times that now. He wanted to bet $100 million, half his fortune, on going to Mars. And he's still there and almost there. Do you know that he said recently, by end of the year, next year, he hopes to have an Optimus robot on Mars, which I think is a pretty amazing thing. And I think it would have been front page news, except the media have now decided that he's bad because Trump is bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, and oddly enough, he was their hero for a really long time.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. You got to wonder. I mean, these are the people who wanted to save the Earth, and they loved him for saving the Earth with electric vehicles. And now some of them are torching electric vehicles and lithium batteries and sending terrible cascading chemicals into the sky. It's so bizarre.
Yeah, in the name of I don't know what. I guess always the funniest thing to me is when they start up with he's not elected.
Yeah, neither is everyone else in Washington, and they've been spending money like crazy. And the thing is, lesson two of my 11 lessons of Elon in the leadership genius of Elon Musk. Lesson two says reduce, 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 and Elon has done this all his life, okay? A couple years ago, he sold off half a dozen homes worth $120 million. He doesn't even own a home now. The Tesla has 10,000 parts compared with 40,000 in a Ford. That's more things that can go wrong. With SpaceX, the Starship, the largest craft ever launched into space, 100 feet taller than the Statue of Liberty on her pedestal. The first time they had that thing take off, his engineer said, we better reinforce the launch pad with steel rods. He said, nah, leave them out. Let's just go, you know, less, less, less. And it blew apart that entire launch pad and sent, on first launch, and sent chunks the size of sofas, you know, 5 miles out into the sea. So Elon decided, okay, I guess we got to put that back in. So now he comes to government, and he wants to cut $1 trillion. Now understand, every year we spend $2 trillion more than the $4 trillion, $5 trillion that we take in taxes, right? That's the deficit. $2 trillion. Oh my gosh. He wants to cut it by $1 trillion a year. That's 14% of spending. The government could easily afford that, but suddenly it's a national crisis and we have thousands of people, many of them elderly and many of them paid protesters, now upset that Elon wants to reduce, reduce, reduce in one of the fattest, most incompetent, inefficient entities in the world, the U.S. government.
And they've been talking about reducing the size of government for years and years. And, you know, a lot of them get elected on that. And now that we're doing it, oh, my gosh, it's a national crisis. You can't do that. Well, I think he's proven them wrong.
I mean, Dennis, come on. The idea that by reducing the workforce, right, that somehow is going to impact productivity, I ask people all the time. I'm like, well, let's see. During the Obama era, we increased the work, the federal workforce by 30%. Did you see a massive increase in productivity and responsiveness from the federal agencies?
No. No, and look at Twitter. I mean, I heard that he went in and cut almost 70% of the workforce.
80%.
Actually, I heard it was 80%.
Yeah.
In about 2 weeks. And then 2 weeks after cutting 80% of staff at Twitter, the platform hosted almost 140 billion impressions in a matter of 2 weeks about the World Cup.
Yeah.
Soccer playoffs.
They never missed a beat.
And so all those people were not necessary at all. And by the way, many of them then became, you know, they went on to jobs they liked. And but look at the federal government. Okay, the Energy Department has a building that houses 4,800 employees. And the DOGE people found out that in 2023, this building, that can house almost 5,000, had an average of 89 people present at work in a given day in 2023. So all these people are staying home. And I think it's a myth when we say, oh, when I'm at home, I'm on call 24-7. I'm working all the time. No, you're not. You're in jammy pants watching reality shows.
Yeah, I don't know who's buying that story.
What surprised you when you started writing this? Were there things in there that you were like, oh, didn't know that?
You know what? I grew such an affection for this man, for his bluntness, for his inability to practice politesse. You know, he says he's on the spectrum. He says he has Asperger's. And you can see him sometimes in Mar-a-Lago in video, right, where he's at some dinner with tables and tables of people. And there he is. He's holding up two intersecting forks that are stuck together. And he's staring at it and revolving it and looking at it. He's clearly thinking about something entirely removed from everyone else. I've been touched by how much he wants to be loved. And I think he didn't feel loved at all as a kid growing up. You know, that Walter Isaacson, only the best biographer of our age, and he's done Edison and Jobs, and now he's done Elon Musk, 688 pages. But for mine, you can read about 250 pages and just figure out how he does what he does, and maybe even borrow some lesson. But he talks about him getting pushed down the stairs in school and his really, really rough father. So that even one of the richest people on earth, and so successful, not just in one thing, the way Jeff Bezos is great at Amazon, but successful at six or seven different things, amazingly so, that he could still have such a desperate need to be loved, that he stands on a stage and holds up his hand and jumps up and down and his T-shirt lifts up and exposes his midriff belly, you know. I mean, it just touches my heart, I got to tell you.
There is.
But I will tell you another really strange thing I found out, and it kind of changed my life the more I dove into it. Do you have the time?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, okay. He's almost childlike a lot of times. You see that, yes, exuberance.
Right. You know, he once told Joe Rogan, because his podcast, he's done four or five of them, and every one of them is so insightful. When you listen to it and then read a transcript of it, he said, I don't think a lot of people would want to be me. Your brain, it just never stops. It is if he's receiving messages from alien voices or something with more ideas all the time. He spouted a single idea, and a couple companies went out and raised $700 million in investment money to pursue it, even though he wasn't involved. And it was this idea of a hyperspace loop underground, San Francisco to L.A., send packages on a rail at 400 miles an hour, let cars go through there at 200 miles an hour. And hundreds of millions of dollars have been raised here and in Europe in pursuit of this hyperspace loop that was simply a dream of his. The guy's amazing. But here's the thing. The opening lesson of the book, which the publisher, HarperCollins, and their Broadside imprint, which is they have like five bestsellers in the past 2 years, they said, don't start with this in publicity because people just won't get it. Well, lesson one says, of the 11 lessons of Elon, lesson one says, all of this may be fake, so just go for it. Elon truly believes the chances may be billions to one in favor of the idea that we are right now living inside a video simulation that is so realistic, so indistinguishable from reality, thousands of years from now, perhaps, that we just don't know it. Now, it sounds ridiculous, but if you came to think of it as being plausible, and I interviewed a physicist who came up with an entirely new law of infodynamics that says it very well may be true, but you could live your life bigger, larger, louder, love more, love out loud. You know, take that high-risk job offer that you would otherwise turn down because you fear failure. You could live bigger just because, heck, it all might be a game anyway. And then when you think about this, guys, you know, the universe is 13.8 billion years old, they say. That means there's almost 1.4 million spans of time that are 10,000 years long. Okay, well, don't we think that it would be easily done 10,000 years from now that you could have a simulation that you don't even know it's not reality because it's so far advanced? Do we really think after almost 1.4 million of those time segments that it hasn't happened anywhere yet?
Yeah. Yeah, it's the possibilities. You know, I think that's where he is so much so much further ahead of most people just because he looks at these possibilities and expands on them.
Well, you see him when they ask him a question. That's always very telling to me. They ask him a question, and he doesn't just blurt something out. A lot of times he just doesn't say anything. It's almost one of those,
uh-oh, he's stumped.
Like there's a lot of dead air there, you know.
But he's really, truly thinking.
Yes.
Instead of being coached by image makers like me, I give guys crisis advice, et cetera, and instead of kind of having pat answers ready, because one rule I give clients is no matter what question you are asked to open an interview, you give the answer that you have ready. And
yeah.
Most times they won't even notice it, and they'll just go with you, okay? Yeah, this guy, he just tells the truth. He's utterly uncoached. And you're right. And those answers is when you really kind of get, and suddenly he'll just stop and stare off into space.
Yeah, right.
Which is uncomfortable for the interviewer because he's thinking. But just one thing. I came across this clip. He's being interviewed by Lex Fridman. This is this deep-voiced Russian-American computer scientist podcaster. And he does these 2-3-hour-long conversations with great interviews. Okay, and but he asks him, if we reach AGI, that ultimate all-knowing, better than humans will ever be AI system, what is it that you would ask her? And Elon pauses for 13 full seconds.
No.
And then finally he says, what's behind the simulation?
Yeah, what is behind the simulation?
What is behind the simulation? Oh my gosh. Dennis,
it's kind of a digital form of God, right? And by the way, the thing is that I'm egotistical enough to believe that if I'm in the simulation, I'm in the first one. But no, there are sub-simulations inside simulations. Characters in this one have their own simulations going on. And who knows that we're not in the fifth or the sixth or the seventh inside little sub-simulation of someone else's simulation.
And all the people that are still trying to figure out how their cell phone works, their heads just exploded.
Yeah.
In deference to them, Dennis, we have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back. Because we know there's more. You're listening to We the People. This will be archived commercial free later this afternoon at wethepeopleradio.us.
So if you're dreaming about California, it don't matter at all where you've played before. California's a brand new game.
And target rich for Elon and the Doge crew.
Absolutely. Dennis, I kind of wanted to go back to SpaceX for just a second.
Sure.
I've always been amazed at the advancements that he's made in space and rockets and all this. I mean, if you look at what NASA's done, which they've done some pretty spectacular stuff, but and I don't know what their budget is, but they have been unable to really do much. And Musk comes along, develops this rocket, and goes to Mars, and is launching all these projects. I mean, Starlink and all this. And do we need NASA? I mean,
well, you know, I got to tell you guys, without SpaceX, there would be no NASA practically. When both SpaceX and Boeing got similar contracts to start ferrying astronauts to the International Space Station, and Boeing's, after SpaceX had done a dozen of these trips pretty successfully, I think it was a dozen or a half dozen, Boeing sends its first flight, and that was 8 months ago, because it had to strand those two astronauts at the station. It couldn't get them home because of the technical problems on the ship. The ship came home without them on its own. And it was Elon Musk's SpaceX who wanted to go right away but was held off, and then finally went, and just a few weeks ago they rescued those two astronauts and brought two more home as well. And that would have been page one news, of course, but I think it was largely ignored. You know, this whole SpaceX thing, though, illustrates two lessons that could help people in business, in their careers, and in life. And the first lesson is lesson eight, dream huge and be willing to spend decades in pursuit, because like I mentioned, he wanted to do this 20 years ago. He still hasn't gotten there, but he will. But then second is lesson 10. Lesson 10 says, it's better to launch and burn than never launch at all. And, you know, he thrives on failure. He sees failure as a necessary step toward success, not as a setback and a hurdle blocking you from success. You know, they learned thousands of details with every explosion. And in the chapter, I map out all the times Starship has exploded or has tried to land again and fallen over. And each time the media would just jeer and jump on him in this failure. And each time he was undeterred, and they would celebrate the success of how much they learned on that mission. And I think more of us could live a better life, build a better life, if we are more willing to embrace failure along the way.
Right, right.
Yes.
Well, if you look at those launches, you know, he's got a room full of pretty young people working on these projects. And that's the way NASA was in the very beginning when we went to the moon. I mean, they were doing calculations on slide rules, and I mean, they were all young, smart guys. Do you think NASA is operating on the same level as SpaceX?
You know, let's just look at NASA in no way as a competitor. NASA is simply a customer. And by the way, SpaceX and Elon Musk are lucky to have NASA as a customer. It's their very biggest customer. They also launch for, you know, Defense Department, and, you know, I believe they launch for CIA satellites, and all along they're bringing their own satellites up there. They've got 6,600 birds in the sky now for that satellite network, right?
Starlink.
It's just an incredible business, Starlink, and it has done really well, and it's going to keep going. I mean, one day I think they'll be challenging cell phone rivals, because even the stuff Elon dreams about, those dreams are even bigger than we know. His effort to get to Mars, and it's based on kind of a pessimistic underlying view that if you don't become multiplanetary, at some point the Earth dies and we die with it. We've got to be somewhere else. If there's a big explosion, the moon, not far enough away, it would get taken out too. So we've got to be on Mars. But he actually thinks from there, we go to a moon of Jupiter. From there, perhaps out to the asteroid belt. So even though I've been thinking, oh, his goal, his big dream, huge with Mars. No, it's even more huge than that. And the same for that brain chip for Neuralink company. There's two human beings now with a brain chip. Paraplegics, quadriplegics, they can control the cursor on the screen. The first guy said, man, I can whip anybody in a video game now. It's so fast, which is kind of interesting. But Elon has said that in 20 or 30 years, millions of us, able-bodied people, may be walking around with brain chips in our head, because right now when AI talks to us, AI can talk and compute it. You know, quadrillions of instructions per second. We're at a million or so. So AI feels like it's talking to a tree waiting for an answer that may never come. We're so slow. But we'll have brain chips, Elon argues, and be able to interact with AI far faster. So even that paraplegic chip, I thought, which was aimed at a huge enough dream, there is even bigger.
Well, isn't the chip allowing? I thought I heard that it was allowing them to actually control their limbs again.
Well, I haven't heard that, but I do know that this Optimus robot that he's got at Tesla, where he says thousands of them in the next 10 years will be in homes and everyone will have one at a cost of $10,000, like buying a, you know, much cheaper than a car. You know, I forgot what my point was, but I was just so fascinated by that, the idea of that robot.
Well, I've seen pictures of that.
He thinks an amputee could attach an Olympus, Olympus or Optimus robot arm to his body, and then control it with the brain chip, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
He's got all kinds of synergy working between these big, among these different businesses that seem so utterly separated, right? I mean, look at what he just had his AI company, X.AI, buy his social media X platform, which the media insisted he was destroying and ruining, and actually is today, let's admit it, the most important media platform in the world. I mean, it's just amazingly influential. It has all of the breaking news. It's quoted, the stuff that officials say on that platform is quoted as dogma in the New York Times and everywhere else. And it's just, he's freed it, and he's done anything but destroy it. And so now he has XAI buy it, and XAI feeds on, you know, each of these AI engines learn by reading stuff, right? That's why the Wall Street Journal just sold rights to OpenAI for GPT to read the journal for $250 million, because that's so much content. Well, X posts 6,000 messages per second, 24/7.
Yeah.
And so XAI is learning like crazy off the latest, greatest, and that's why Grok on the X platform is now the best AI engine I use.
Yeah, that technology is moving so fast. I think anybody that would bet against Elon Musk is a fool. I mean, he's so far out there, you can't even comprehend some of the things he sees, and so much of it has actually come to fruition. That's what's fun.
Well, I'm curious, as you were researching, where did was the turn as I don't follow Elon Musk, and I don't follow all the things that he's doing, but it seemed like his fall from grace was absolutely inexorably linked to Donald Trump.
Well, it really was.
Was it that clean?
I said, Aaron, that there's three strikes against them. Now, strike one was when a Delaware judge forced him to proceed with the $44 billion acquisition of Twitter. He wanted to back out of it because it had plummeted in value along with other tech stocks. He was forced to continue with it, and the first thing he did was release the Twitter files that showed the most rampant, widespread, illegal violation of our First Amendment rights by the U.S. government in our history. Now, that instantly made him an enemy of the media, who didn't want him taking over the platform. Then came strike two, where he freed the platform, and I think strike three was, forget it. How dare he side with a bad orange man?
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised, guys, that he didn't just kind of announce that, wow, he just had an assassination attempt on him, and he stood up and said, fight, I can't believe that I hereby endorse him. But then he got involved so heavily, you know, more than $200 million in assistance, although Zuckerberg gave $400 million to Democrat districts in 2020, and no one had a problem with that.
Yeah
no one cared.
And to get up on stage and campaign for him, he did so at great expense to himself. He has cited literally 17,000 death threats and two attempts, okay? And it also, you know, Tesla's down 30-40% from its highs recently. I own that stock. So it's hurt his companies. It's hurt his investors. It's hurt him. And why? He's trying to help this country because he felt that there was an emergency. We are going to bankrupt ourselves.
Yeah.
And we are the last shining light of hope in the world.
Is there, as you were traveling through, you know, the history with, you know, with Elon Musk and looking into his philosophy and all that, did you get any insight at all on, like, any kind of, I don't know, endpoint for the people who supposedly hate him, are they ever going to figure it out, or are they just going to manufacture reasons to be angry and protest and light stuff on fire?
No one else. You do enough of these interviews, and I've been fortunate enough to do a couple dozen here, and so to ask a question that no one else has is great. And I got to tell you, I'm thinking that the Democrat Party, the liberal movement, the radicals, the whole spectrum, Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ, pro-Hamas protesters, pro-Palestinians, all of that spectrum, they gain if people are upset.
Yeah.
They gain attention, they gain donations, and they want to stoke this negative bitterness, this constant fear. I mean, and the problem is their own followers are getting tired of it. They kept telling them how horrible it would be. He's going to end democracy. He's racist, et cetera. And yet he got the highest number of black votes of any Republican candidate ever, I think it was, in the most recent election. They're not buying it. They're not believing it. And then to have all these protests that are against what? Cutting waste in government spending? What? What are you doing?
How do you justify that?
And you've got this X platform now. Here's the big difference. Is that X platform is allowing free speech to ring true and conservative speech to ring out. And so you see these amazing videos calling out one politician or another for blatant lies and double talk. And it's changed everything in terms of the debate. There are 100 million Americans now. I think it's up from 40 million 2 years ago. 100 million Americans on X. And that's where the news really breaks. And that's where you see a much fuller picture than what most liberal media outlets are willing to tell you, because they're burying stories. I wrote more columns and did more podcasts for What's Bugging Me on the Twitter files, I was so upset by it, than the entire staff of the New York Times and the Washington Post combined.
Yeah, not surprising.
Because they didn't care that conservatives were being censored, but then let the Trump administration arrest a pro-Palestine protester who orchestrated anti-Semitic protests at Columbia University and who's a foreigner with a green card. Let us try to, get him out of the country. And suddenly the media are standing up for free speech.
Yeah, right. Because it's an oligarchy. Because Elon Musk is working for free and tanking his own company to help deal with the national debt. And we're living it's hard to know, though. I don't think they really actually know what these things mean, because it's an oligarchy, it's fascism, at some point you can't have all those things at the same time.
Well, there was a video of a kid protesting, he's holding a sign, fascist, and the interviewer is asking, why is Trump a fascist? And he doesn't know. He's just holding a sign he was given.
Yeah.
This is, what they call it, guys, the astroturfing.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody's Hitler, right? Elon Musk now has, they're painting swastikas all over everything, and it's like...
See, that's the other thing, is I saw a story in the New York Times. Is painting a swastika on a Tesla, is it a hate crime, or is it an attack on Musk? They're making excuses, hoping that, this is just an attack on Musk, as if that's an okay thing,
Yeah.
I can't believe it. And by the way, guys, the Democrats are othering Elon Musk now. He's a South African oligarch. He doesn't understand our ways. The guy has the zeal of a convert. He has so much respect for the First Amendment. That's lesson six. Free speech is everything. Stand up and make yourself heard. Stand up and be heard. And he believes that more than most Americans. Did you guys know that something like 40% of Americans don't realize the First Amendment protects movies, TV, protects books? They don't even know. It turns out one-third of America believes that it's more important to prevent hate speech than it is to protect free speech. They don't realize that the First Amendment protects even hate speech that you abhor.
Yeah.
And yet they don't know. And another third of Americans, they're not sure. So two-thirds of Americans fail to realize that the First Amendment is the bedrock of everything else. It allows us to criticize government out loud and force change. And if you can't criticize, my God, in the UK, they're putting people in jail for 2 years for something they said online.
Oh, yeah.
It's just horrible.
Yeah, isn't that terrific? Well, let's face it, most of these guys don't realize, you know, we're going to save democracy. I'm always like, you know, how many times does democracy appear in the Constitution? Oh, yeah, that's right, zero. We're not a democracy. We're a republic, for heaven's sakes. And I do ask them when Elon wasn't elected. I always ask them, like, wow, that's weird. You know, how many people in the executive branch are elected?
Right.
And then you have that really long pause that doesn't have the insightful answer like Elon Musk gives after the 13 seconds.
And Aaron, who else is unelected? The federal judiciary.
Exactly.
The judges. The 677 judges who now, in 99 federal districts, who now think each one, apparently, has power equal to that of the only person in our entire government who's voted on by the entire country,
right,
the President of the United States.
Right. That's the part that just, and it's, you know, I've actually asked quite a few people, too, you know, well, if he's not elected, but he's there advising the president, and the president is the one making the decision in the end, doesn't that solve the problem? And
right.
I don't usually get a good answer,
you know,
on that one either.
I'm just so floored by Musk's courage.
Yeah.
And his blunt. I mean, when he says, "Let's look at the congressmen who make only $175,000 per year, and yet they're now worth, you know, $10 million and $20 million after a few years in Washington. How can that be?" No one else has ever called that out before, because what you're doing is you're making direct enemies who can then have you investigated. It, you know, and you better not be doing anything wrong when you start to mess with that, because as Chuck Schumer, my senator here in New York, unfortunately, once said, you can't mess with the CIA and that whole establishment, because they have six different ways to go at you. That's what he said as Trump was running the first time, I believe it was.
Yep.
Well, you look at all of the agencies. And so when people, you know, people get really wrapped around the axle, oh, we can't possibly, you know, readjust the federal, you know, the volume of the federal workforce, like there's some sort of, you know, that's sacrosanct. And it's like, there is no job that is forever. There is no career that's forever. Oh, there is not necessarily a business
or
that
guaranteed
is forever. That's what I'm saying.
Well, and by the way, government workers, and they've cut, I think it's like 140,000 jobs so far, out of close, I think it's 2 million.
It's over 2 million, yes.
They're now going through what our workforce, we in the workforce, have been going through for 20 years of cutbacks and early retirement and downsizing. I mean, welcome to the world, guys.
Well, just look at the Keystone Pipeline guys. What were they told? Oh, you got to learn computer coding.
Learn to code, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and the other thing is, they say that if you can't cut anything, there was an astounding op-ed in the Wall Street Journal last week that cited figures about Medicaid. Medicaid, by the way, is now the number one or number two item in state budgets across the land.
Mm-hmm.
Medicaid started out in 64 for only, you know, poor mothers who couldn't go to work, they couldn't afford babysitters, and disabled elderly people. And it later now covers, you know, 25-year-old, fully able-bodied men who are home playing video games. And they pointed out that something like $1.38, I think it was, $1 trillion more is spent on families that are not poor. It turns out by Medicaid, they don't really need it. The Census Bureau says that the poverty line's at $17,000 because it rules out 90% of government aid, doesn't count it as income. So the real income level is $65,000 for these families with all the aid they get. But we're looking at it as if they earn only 17 and giving them all this aid. So there's just a lot of stuff going on.
And then what did we learn? Like over the last 10 years, we had $2.7 trillion in Medicaid funding that left the country.
Right.
Left the country.
Exactly.
You can't even, it's against the law. You can't even do that.
Right. And the $2.2 million non-citizens coming in the last year of Biden who got Social Security numbers, Social Security cards, basically, and then 1.3 million of them are on Medicaid public assistance. And all along, we were told, no, illegals are not getting Medicaid here. Oh, yes, they are. These guys just found it. It's just amazing what Elon Musk is uncovering. And then talk about killing the messenger, man. They're going after Elon because their own ox is getting gored. And by the way, both parties are at the same trough here. Republicans, didn't Republicans just pass out of committee or something, something to take away Trump's single tariff power so that they would have to approve tariffs? That is totally undermining what Trump is doing, and they ought to get the heck out of the way.
There's quite a bit. There's quite a bit, and then the lens that you see it all through, of course, is it depends on who you're listening to. There seems to be no factual center. You either have the complete hype, on the right that Trump is a monster and a dictator and he's taking over the world and Elon Musk is his puppet.
On the left.
What is it? What did I say? On the right?
Yeah.
What's wrong with me today?
I don't know.
I'm backwards. I'm going to blame Bill.
Yeah.
Bill did it. And then on the right, they're hamstringing the president and he needs to be able to do everything. It's like, there's no win.
Well, bottom line is if the richest man in the world wants to sit down with you and give you some financial advice, are you going to listen to him or are you going to argue with him? I mean, I think you'd listen. Well, I think any one of us would love to sit down one-on-one with Elon Musk and get some financial advice.
Yeah.
Nobody can argue with that.
Well, they make it sound like he's running everything by himself, that he's making all these unilateral decisions, and that just isn't the way it's happening, and that isn't the way it works.
Yeah, he's about to back away, right? There's a 130-day window in which you can be a special government appointee without requiring any approval, disclosures, et cetera. That period's about to end. So the reports are from inside the administration, as quoted in various sources, that he'll be backing away. And that'll maybe remove the lightning rod. But I guarantee you he will be in touch and will be still able to exercise influence there. And, great leadership. And that's the title of the book, The Leadership Genius of Elon Musk. It requires not just that you are this bold leader, right, but you have lieutenants who can execute your vision while you go tend to other stuff. And he does have that. Look at that new superstar, Antonio Gracias, I think it is. He's a venture investor. He's worth over $2 billion. He just dove into Social Security. He did the onstage rally in Wisconsin, an onstage presentation with Elon about those Social Security numbers for all of these illegal aliens. And so guys like that are going to take over.
And it just came out, right? Didn't it just come out that, was it Border Patrol or Homeland Security, somewhere in that, that they came out and said, hey, look, the Biden administration made us give these guys Social Security numbers.
Right, they finally admitted that they were ordered to do this.
Yeah.
And where was the media all the time? Do you know that Elon Musk, I think it was last year, actually traveled to Eagle Pass at the Texas border to shine a light on just the flood of immigrants there? He's there interviewing two officials, right, a congressman and a sheriff. And he's fascinated to find that this one guy comes in and he's got, two teardrops tattooed, below his eye. Oh, and that means he killed two different men in prison. And as he's talking, he kind of pans with his phone, and there's 15 more illegals crossing the border, just, nonchalantly walking past. And it focused millions of people on this issue in a way that the media had not done because it didn't want to hurt Biden. They were all in for Biden, and they were afraid of damaging his chances. And so X has been the great equalizer in that sense, and we owe Elon Musk for that. I think, you don't spend over a year of your life deeply, going after and researching and begging this guy to talk to you. You don't do that for a guy you think is a jerk. You do it for someone you admire.
Right.
And I really admire him. I think he's one of the best things to happen to America in 100 years. And I think we owe him. And I'm grateful for him. And I think more people will be after they read my book.
Right. And how many people can you think of that could walk into Washington, D.C. in less than 100 days and actually get something achieved? And look what he's done, and all they want to do is vilify him.
And the only other person I could name would be Donald Trump, because what has happened in his first 60 days or so? has been nothing short of extraordinary, and it was orchestrated. And he's setting so many fires in so many places that his opponents have no idea where to turn, and you can see them lurching from one strategy to another. And I wonder if going after Elon Musk is working. I don't know. I haven't heard takedown Tesla in a few days, so maybe not.
I don't know. Aren't they having some? Did they have it yesterday?
Yeah, yesterday
they have
was
thousands and thousands of protesters. But there's a guy you might follow on X called Tony Saruga, okay? And he has the ESNs of millions or every electronic device in the U.S., and he can track them. And he shows that at these protests that are supposed to be grassroots, first of all, always they're saying it's 35,000 people when it was 20,000, which is still a lot, okay. But he then finds that the vast majority of the people there have been to the previous 10 Kamala Harris rallies, or they've been to Black Lives Matter protests. So this is a professional protest class. And by the way, look for Elon Musk to sue the half dozen AdBlue-funded, Democrat-geared organizations that are basically being pushed by the Democrats to go after him and to vandalize Tesla sites. I mean, he will go after them, and they will pay a price.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember that interview.
Yes, they should. You know, you can't run a free society with a First Amendment where the minute you say something people don't like, they come and burn down whatever, your house, your car, your business. That isn't part of the deal. I mean, that just isn't part of the deal, and it shouldn't be tolerated.
Right. And yet, I really admire Musk for he still is pushing forward. He still is teasing his critics and torturing his enemies rather than surrender, rather than kind of pipe down. And I'll bet you after he backs away from the formal role because of that rule, I'll bet you he continues to crusade and continues to out various outrages that they find, because they're finding incredible stuff, and we should all be against it. The Democrats, I've been a lifelong registered Democrat, though I've not voted for one in years because they left me. But it would be great if the Democrats could find some overlapping things with Trump and work to get some things done that might help. And I mean, I think the homeless situation could really use some help. I think we could use a whole lot more mental institutions and halfway houses or something. But they can't sit down with a guy that they've been calling Hitler for 10 years.
Yeah, that makes it really tough. And the other part of it is they really have to stop misrepresenting everything. I mean, if you have a system like Social Security, like Medicare, like all of those, that is, they've said over and over and over, and in the budget resolution, those words never appeared, so they were not being cut. They're not being worked on to be cut. They're looking at who's on there that doesn't belong in there. They're looking at it, is the money being misspent? And they're looking to make those programs more solvent. But, I mean...
Exactly. They're trying to help them survive, aren't they?
Yeah, but you can't talk about it. I always joke, you know, I'm like, if we just called, we could have a, you know, we could have a caucus or a you know, we could have a meeting place about Social Security, but we'd probably have to call it Ferris Wheel Ride, you know, because you can't say Social Security because then you want to kill it. But it doesn't matter how many times they say it. You heard Cory Booker the other night, you know, old Spartacus, was yapping on for 24 hours about how all these people are going to be hurt because they're going to take away all of their, you know, the support systems that they rely on. And it just isn't happening.
And meanwhile, people who are covered by Medicare and Social Security, they're continuing to get their checks. There's been no change. And yet the Social Security Fund, it is going to go bankrupt in 5 years or so. We already are spending about 10 or 20% more than we take in from Social Security taxes. I mean, 20 years ago, I think it was, we had six earners for every one retiree. Today, it's fewer than three in the workforce for every one retiree. We've got 10,000 people in the U.S. every single day hitting age 65. And it turns out that... I had this on my podcast, What's Bugging Me, the other day. It turns out that while in business, the first place you cut often is personnel. Because in business, the HR costs are 60% of business. But in government, it turns out, because it hands out so much money, $2 trillion a year, employees are only 4% of total spending.
Wow.
So Elon will not get to his $1 trillion only cutting jobs. He's got to go after not Social Security benefits. but go after Social Security waste. I mean, he found, what was it, 20 million people looked at as still alive and over age 120. And that is basically just a cover for fraud. He found a Small Business Administration loan of $100,000
went to a nine-month-old infant. Yeah. How do you, I just don't understand how you protest that, how you complain about it.
Oh, you just call it a lie. I just saw it this morning. It's all lies. That never happened.
You just made it up.
Yeah, you just made it up.
Huh, I like that.
Yeah.
Gosh, Dennis, we're creeping in here. Don't want to cut you off unceremoniously since we introduced you unceremoniously. Maybe I can make it up at the end.
You know, I'm hoping, because I want as many people to hear this interview as possible, because I want to sell this book, baby.
We want to sell the book, The Leadership Genius of Elon Musk, with our new best friend Dennis Neal. Yay, Kneale. We should point out. Dennis.
Follow me on Twitter. Are we wrapping here?
Yeah, we are. We got to blow.
I appreciate your time so much, guys. I hope this goes viral, and I hope you have a glorious day.
Absolutely.
We're going to put your book on the website.
It's on there.
Yeah.
We want you to come back.
I'd love to come back. I'd be honored.
Awesome. You can find this whole thing at wethepeopleradio.us.
We're all good men talking.